I'm very moved to be here with you tonight. We've kind of come to a milestone together as a community, or with me, that I'll be basically giving this series of four talks this Thursday and the coming three Thursdays, and then next year I plan to give no Dharma talks at local sanghas and only to offer retreats. I'm kind of devolving from work. We've been meeting for a long time. And I just want to honor this community. I visited a friend here in Albuquerque in 1989. That's 21 years ago. And he told me about the sitting group that Joan Granger had at her home. And so it dates back at least to 1989 and probably sometime before that. The first talk that I gave for this Sangha was in 1994 at Joan's house. And then when I moved to this area to become the resident teacher in Santa Fe, in January 1997, we decided that I would be the resident teacher here as well. And I came here twice a month for years. We met first in Wynette's living room, then somebody's loaned basement, and then we see the Quaker Meeting House, and then the Unitarian Church, and then the Nahalat Shalom Center, and here. And have I missed any?
Adelante,
you're right, of course, Adelante. So there's been dozens of talks over these years, all the same stuff over and over again. I don't know. You guys are gluttons for punishment. So I want to really honor this community. I want to honor Joan Granger, who essentially provided the seed for this community to happen. And I want to honor, I know Hillary's here, Hillary Heil is here, who started a sitting group in the 1990s with others. I want to honor, you know, I talked to Joan just a few days ago. She's dealing with brain cancer, and she's in a assisted care facility in Denver. She told me she's very homesick for Albuquerque. And so I think let's just hold her in our hearts as the kind of the mother of this community. But I also want to honor so many people who have given so much effort to keep this community going. It takes a whole lot of energy and time and skill to put on a retreat, and this community has put on many retreats. And it's all generosity. Ken was just talking about generosity. It's like every person who has ever worked in this community has received exactly nothing in terms of money in return. Pure generosity of giving. I really want to honor that. And to say, you're my community. I take refuge in you. And I really love you guys. So, and I'd like to, I'm going to offer this series of four talks, and I would really like to keep it simple. I'm finding that the more and more I do this spiritual practice, the more and more it gets really simple. It doesn't get more complicated. It is on the very simplest level. You know, I mentioned that the Buddha said that our suffering comes from the reactivity of our minds. When I was giving a sitting instruction, you know, we grasp for and try to hold on to what we want, and we resist. We try to get rid of what we don't want. He said that pattern of reactivity is actually what causes our suffering and perpetuates our suffering. That there is actually a more fundamental cause of our suffering, the Buddha said, and the most fundamental cause of our suffering is that we believe we're separate. And it's out of that sense of separation that all of our pain comes from. And to me, it just becomes simpler and simpler. You know, I notice when I'm feeling separate, and I notice that I'm suffering. And I notice when I'm feeling really connected, and I can feel the happiness that comes from that. You know, it doesn't require anything more than that. It's that simple. And yet the habit of separation is so deep in us, so profoundly deep, it takes a long time for many of us. For some people, it's real quick. Eckhart Tolle, bless his soul, sat down on a park bench in misery and stood up awake. It happens occasionally. I'm so glad for Eckhart. but for most of us, it's a long, hard slog. You know, I've been doing this practice for 35 years. 36 years. So really simple. So I'd like to, in this series, essentially what I'd like to do is to describe two things, essentially two related things. One is to really describe the whole transpersonal journey, that is, the whole journey that we go through to liberate our minds and hearts. I think it's really useful to have a map. So I'd like to talk about that, but I'd also like to talk about how we can cultivate our freedom moment to moment, day to day, right in the midst of our lives. And I'd like to keep it really simple. So just in terms of the titles that I've given to these talks, are the first talk, this one, is about ascent, A-S-C-E-N-T, about joy, about forms of happiness. Next week's the bummer, but come. It's about descent, D-E-S-C-E-N-T. It's about opening to pain, which is also necessary for our happiness. And the third is about what I've been calling peace at the end, which is about equanimity, about a very stable, sweet, simple, open, and accepting heart. And then the fourth is about beyond the end, you know, about the experience of awakening, about compassion, and about turning back toward the world in order to be helpful. So I'd like to just describe, a little bit what this path is, and just at least just the initial part of that path. And that is that if you want to free yourself, you know, the Buddha said, again, really simple formulation. He said, just do three things. Do good, avoid doing harm, and purify your heart through meditation. He said, that's all you need to do. And so our training is to undertake the training to try to avoid harming, to act ethically in the world, to try to be helpful and to avoid harming. And this is a training, and we blow it all the time, and we forgive ourselves, and we keep doing it. It's a very beautiful spiritual practice in itself, ethical conduct. It brings a lot of happiness. Really simple. Just one little tiny example. I was just remembering recently, I was backpacking alone in the Grand Canyon in 1980. And I went down from the North Rim and I camped at Cottonwood Camp, which is about halfway down Bright Angel Canyon. And in the morning, before I kept walking down to the Colorado, to the Inner Canyon, it's, you know, Cottonwood Camp is in the middle of nowhere, but somehow or other they had electricity and they had running water. And I was using the urinal in the men's room, and I looked down and there was a scorpion caught in the urinal. And I went and spoke to the ranger and I said, what should I do? And she said, flush it down. It hadn't even occurred to me. And so I went and I got two flat sticks. And if you can imagine all this urine and me kneeling in front of the urinal, and the scorpion was terrified, was waving its tail, was absolutely terrified. And I was very, very carefully catching the scorpion, taking it out and releasing it in the dust. And it sort of trailed. I was all wet. It sort of trailed off through the dust. And I know this sounds weird. This was 30 years ago, and I still feel very connected to that scorpion. You know, because I saved its life. is really that simple. But it was really a deep sense of connection. If separation is what causes our suffering, little acts of kindness like this is what keeps us feeling connected. And it's connection that brings us happiness. It's non-separation that brings us happiness. Just a tiny little example. That was September 1980. I remember that scorpion. Does it make sense? So we make the commitment to practice non-harming sila, it's called in Pali. And it's not like, you know, commandments chiseled in stone. It's really about bringing happiness to ourselves and to others through kindness. So we do good, we try to avoid doing harm, we forgive ourselves when we harm, start over, and then we purify ourselves, our hearts and minds through meditation practice. I'd like to just describe very briefly the initial stages of the meditation practice as our practice begins to deepen. In a sense, the first task that any meditator has, and that's true in any spiritual tradition, and I'm including the Western spiritual traditions of Judaism and Islam and Christianity with their prayers, because prayer can have the same function as meditation. So this is not about being exclusive and sectarian. But the initial task is to tranquilize our minds, to bring calm to our hearts. I was talking to an experienced meditator yesterday evening, and this meditator said to me, I don't really relate to the word happiness, but what I experience is that I'm calm, I'm peaceful, and things don't bother me very much. Would you like that? Calm, peaceful, things don't bother me very much. And so our first task is to tranquilize our minds. And we do that by just as I shared in the instructions for the meditation practice, when you notice that your mind has wandered, our minds are cascading with thoughts and stories. But they can be trained. It's not that the thoughts and stories don't come, but we less and less we identify with them. We see them more as a process and not so much don't get caught up in the content of the story so much anymore. But we keep coming back to a chosen meditation object. So we deepen concentration. And concentration is basically the quality of one-pointedness of mind. It's a stable mind that doesn't wander so much. And as concentration gets stronger and stronger, and all it requires is to keep coming back, keep coming back, keep coming back. Every moment when you're actually present and aware of anything that is happening, like right now, if you can feel your body sitting, you know, and just keep coming back to that experience of the body sitting, knowing that you're hearing as well, if you just keep coming back to be present for whatever is actually happening in the moment, then concentration comes as a result of that awareness. As the mind becomes more and more one-pointed and doesn't wander as much, it becomes calm. The concentration brings to it the quality of tranquility or calm. It's a great blessing. Now, what really interferes with our feeling more happiness? One, we're distracted, and two, we're anxious. And anxiety pulls us away. You know, we can have lots and lots of other emotions. There can be all kinds of other emotions, but, you know, it's that basic underlying background anxiety that basically keeps us from being happy. And as the mind gets calmer, that anxiety falls into the background. It doesn't disappear, but it falls more and more into the background, and we're able to rest in that quality of peacefulness. That in itself is a wonderful form of happiness. to have a mind that's calm. And as we go deeper and deeper with deeper and deeper concentration, what comes, what manifests, what makes up a concentrated mind? They're called the jhanic factors. The qualities that make up a concentrated mind. There are two qualities particularly that bring tremendous happiness. As you go deeper and deeper into concentration, your mind becomes more and more purified. The painful experience in our lives is locked out when you're deeply concentrated. That's why it's our minds actually go into a kind of celestial or heavenly state, and two qualities appear. One is rapture, which is a joyous, delighted interest in our experience. It's wonderful. You know, I walked into the room this evening and I just loved the gleaming gold. You know, it really touched me. And it warms my heart. Now, I couldn't appreciate that gleaming gold if my mind is filled with anxiety. Does that make sense? In other words, there has to be, our hearts and minds, it's not so much that we cultivate joy, it's just we have to kind of clear out, and then joy appears by itself because it's our natural state. And just notice it with anything. You know, you can be staring at the most beautiful bouquet of flowers you've ever seen, and if your mind is agitated and caught up in stuff and obsessed, you're not really going to see that beautiful bouquet of flowers. If the mind is a little bit calm and a little bit empty, then that joyous response can happen. And it's a really beautiful, it's lovely to live with a sense of delighted interest. It's just lovely, and it can appear anywhere. It can appear with a scorpion in a urinal. Anywhere. And then the other quality that comes as our minds become more and more concentrated is actually a quieter form of happiness, which we sometimes call bliss. It's a calm, sweet happiness. Rapture is a little more excited. You know, rapture is the oh wow experience that we've all had. You know, speaking of the Grand Canyon, if you have been to the Grand Canyon, if you can remember the first moment that you looked down into that canyon, probably there was an oh wow. I almost walked into it, didn't know it was there in the moonlight. It was, the first time, I didn't know I was at the Grand Canyon. 1968, I wasn't stoned, I swear. But that quality of oh wow, or the amazing, you know, the amazing that oh wow that you can feel when you see a beautiful sunset. You know, one of my friends used to say about beautiful sunsets, God spent a lot on that one. You know, so we all know what rapture is. We all know that quality of delight. As you do this practice, more and more that quality is there. And then there's this quality of a kind of simple contentment, which is really what bliss is, of being content. I know that sounds minor, but it isn't. So to notice, what is it that really interferes with our experiencing these forms of happiness? And what is it that actually brings us to experience more and more of them? And it's that quality of purifying. And these two elements of our practice reinforce each other. As we do more good in terms of being helpful to ourselves and to others, and we do less harm, that brings a kind of happiness and a kind of peacefulness and a kind of self-respect. Actually, the Buddha said that self-respect is the greatest benefit of ethical conduct. When you have that quality of self-respect, then it's so much easier than to get your mind concentrated. We all know this. You know, if people are habitually doing great harm, then their minds tend to be very agitated and anxious. You know, they're afraid of being caught, they're afraid of reprisal, they're afraid of punishment, their minds are full of guilt and remorse. So it's really hard to concentrate your mind if you're habitually harming. If you've made an effort, you know, I'm still harming all the time, but I've been making an effort for more than 30 years now. Quite a bit more than 30 years. And I'm doing a lot less harm. And helping a lot more. And there's a lot more happiness. So the ethical conduct reinforces the concentration. And as we go deeper and deeper into the concentration, we get the benefit of the happiness of calm and peacefulness. We get the benefit of rapture, of joyous, delighted response to our experience. We get the benefit of bliss, of this contented quality. And it doesn't require anything to be contented. You know, you don't need to be in Vegas to be contented. You know, you don't need to be on a cruise liner to be contented. My favorite place in the world is my front porch. You know, I live in a mobile home and my front porch is quite small, but it's got room for a couple of chairs and it's looking out on a beautiful mountain. And I spend a lot of time on my porch. You know, just looking out and enjoying the peace. I'd like to then, so I've been talking about the formal meditation practice and what happens, or our formal practice, but I'd like to just sort of bring this whole subject now around to our daily lives. And to really look at what are the other kinds of happiness that we can experience. And I really want to clarify one thing. I think that there is a deep misunderstanding of Buddhism, and I think there's a deep misunderstanding within Buddhism about sense pleasure. And when I mean sense pleasure, the pleasure of touch, the pleasure of seeing beautiful things, the pleasure of hearing beautiful things, the pleasure of smelling beautiful things, the pleasure of tasting beautiful things, the pleasure of the intellect, of enjoying beautiful ideas. Essentially, pleasure has gotten a bad rap in Buddhism, and I want to be really clear because I want to make a distinction that it feels to me incredibly important. There is no problem with pleasure. Our only problem with pleasure is when we get attached to it and we want more. If we can experience something pleasant and let it pass away when it passes away without grasping for more, there is no problem whatsoever. And then you can experience the happiness of pleasure. This has been a wonderful discovery for me. I'm way more into pleasure than I used to be, and it's not really... Yeah, hey. Sex is better at 65 than it's ever been before. And it tends not to be a problem because there's less and less attachment. There's a real understanding everything has to pass away. And there's an acceptance of that impermanence. And once that's there, then, you know, the chocolate mousse can be wonderful and you don't need another helping. This is really quite wonderful. So this is not something I've learned from the Buddhists, not anything I've learned from the traditional teachings. It's something that I've really learned from observing this mind and heart. But I've really come to have a wonderful time dancing, and many of you have heard me talk about this before, dancing with the quality of pleasure and rapture. You know, I mentioned this delighted interest in experience. Well, that delighted interest really comes from sense pleasure. A beautiful sunset, a beautiful flower, a beautiful sound. Thanks to the generosity of someone who's here tonight, I listened to an extraordinarily gifted cello player last night and was profoundly moved by a really wonderful artist. And I took delight in listening to that cello performance. I don't see where the problem is you know, of experiencing that pleasure as long as I didn't need to have it continue. Does that make sense? So there's the normal conditioning of we want pleasant experience and we want to hold on to it. If we let go of the holding on and simply experience pleasure as pleasure and let it pass when it passes, it essentially turns into rapture. Is this too complicated? This is just, I know these are abstract sounding words, but this is something when you live it, it's so wonderful. I'm having so much better a time than I've ever had in my life. Indulging in pleasure. Not a lot. I do live in a mobile home. Not a lot, but and it tends to be very simple pleasures. It doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to be expensive. So seeing that we get happiness from pleasure, and what I'd like to suggest, you know, if you're going to come back next week, I'd like to not offer homework because that sounds like it's a project. I don't suggest we make a project out of it, but just really watch. Watch your experience of pleasure. You know, whatever pleasure it is, physical, in terms of physical sensations, the senses that can be affected are basically the ears, hearing, eyes, seeing, nose, smelling, taste, tongue, tasting, body, feeling, sensation, and the mind. Watch your experience with pleasant experience. And notice how you're responding to pleasant experience. Really, you know, this can really be transformative. And without judgment, you know, okay, you taste that wonderful chocolate, that Godiva chocolate or whatever, and if you can just be fully there with the experience, without the mind wandering off into a story, if you can be fully present for the experience of the Godiva chocolate, it becomes a complete experience and you don't need the next one. You know, but if the craving for the next one comes up, just notice that. Don't judge it. It's just conditioning. It doesn't belong to anybody. So, working with pleasure, working with rapture, you know, see when you experience delight over the next week. And notice the conditions that required that to happen, that quality of delight. You know, basically the mind has to be free from anxiety. It needs to be free from obsession. It needs to be free from being lost entirely in story. It needs to be a little bit cleared in order for that delight to happen. I'd like to suggest some other things that we might do in over this week in terms of we're talking about asset. We're talking about forms of happiness here. But I'd like to bore you a little, actually, with a very, very prosaic account of what's been happening to me in the last couple of days. And it's so ordinary that it can feel really boring. But let me just share with you a little bit of what has been happening in the last couple of days. Yesterday morning, I had a telephone conversation. I was just about to leave my home. It was really midday yesterday. I was about to leave home to come here to Albuquerque. And someone called who's been a student for many years, who is someone way out on the margins and is basically holding on to life by her fingernails and has been for years and years and years. Someone who's on disability, someone who has enormous physical challenge in their life and also enormous emotional challenge. So it's someone who's profoundly marginalized, who's just making it. And it's been one of my tasks in the last few years is to try to help her to survive. And so I picked up the phone just as I was about to leave the house. It was this student who was in tears, you know, just basically in an enormous amount of suffering. And I had to say gently, you know, I could only be with her for a couple of minutes because I had to leave home. But what I tried to do, you know, is essentially over the phone, is basically to reach out 1,100 or 1,200 miles and to hold her. I was holding her with the tone of my voice and the quality of the caring. And I said, you know, I really have to leave now, but I will call you on Friday morning when I get back home. And we'll talk tomorrow morning. So this is a conversation with someone in great pain. The response was really being present for this person and feeling compassion, really caring. And you know that presence and that compassion brings happiness because we were connected. We were not disconnected. You know, so one suggestion that you might consider doing in this coming week is to notice the pleasure that comes from caring, from love, from compassion, particularly for people who are distressed or animals who are distressed, beings who are distressed. It's not the beings in your immediate environment, but also when you're watching the news or you're aware of what's happening on the global, you know, is that essentially we can go to grief and pity, which are separating, or we can go to compassion, which is connecting. I know, again, those sound like abstract ideas, but once you actually get it here, there's a big, big difference between grief and pity and compassion. With compassion, it's a kind of love that's willing to go right up to and to touch suffering, to kiss the wounds. And as we develop that quality of compassion deeper and deeper and deeper, there's happiness. It's the happiness of connection. I had another conversation yesterday. A couple of days before, on Tuesday, my partner and I don't live together. We live separately, so we talk a lot on the phone. And we got into a real bump together in communication. And essentially what was happening on Tuesday when we had this conversation and hit a bump with each other is he was in a lot of suffering because he's had nightmares and it's really uncovered a whole thing that he knows he has to work with now. Something has come up from his past. He knows he's got to really work it. And he was suffering a lot. I didn't happen to know this in this conversation. I learned it afterward. And I was there because I was in a lot of distress and was needing support. And the distress that I was feeling is that in the last week, the bubble of denial in this mind and heart has finally broken over global warming. I've finally turned fully toward it, and I've come to accept that it's irreversible, that the consequences will be absolutely catastrophic, that this is the most important thing that has ever happened in the history of humanity, and that we will never have again the sweet earth that we have loved. And so there was a lot of grief, some fear, a little bit of anger, but it was this is a really profound experience for me of kind of coming out of denial about global warming and its consequences and the fact that it cannot be prevented at this point. And it's like a tectonic shift in my understanding of the external world. And here I was alone in my house reading this intense book, probably the most important book I've ever read because it has brought such a change in understanding, and I was needing support. So here you have two distressed people looking for emotional support from each other. Guess what? You know, we hit a bump with each other because I needed support and he needed support and both of us were distressed and we couldn't support each other. So it got a little, you know, it wasn't a problem between us in the sense that he was distressed over something that had nothing to do with me and I was distressed over something that had nothing to do with him. But it was a poor communication. So we spoke yesterday morning. This was on Tuesday, or Monday, I guess, and we spoke on yesterday morning, and we basically went back to that conversation and understood what was happening. We had already apologized to each other for whatever pain came up in the conversation, and we were realizing, oh yeah, in order for someone to provide support to someone else, they need to be strong enough to hold the container of another person's pain, to contain someone else's pain. And it's been just really, my partner is probably the most skilled communicator I've ever met. But in that case, we weren't conscious enough. As we reviewed it, we realized, okay, what we need to do is every time we want support, is to say, to speak the need very explicitly. You know, I'm feeling really distressed right now. I need some emotional support. Can you give it? Is this an okay time? If we had been that explicit with each other, we would have realized, no, we can't give it right now. And there would have been no problem. Does that make sense? So what I'm describing here is actually an aspect of our practice, right speech. And the refinement of right speech. And essentially bringing wisdom and understanding of understanding the causes and conditions that caused the bump between us, going back and clearing it all up, you know, with clarity. And my partner will not let a single thing go by without going back and dealing with it. When I said this 10 minutes ago, your face changed. What were you feeling? Sometimes it feels like a pain in the whatever, but there's no shadow that accumulates between us because we always go back and work it. Does that make sense? So this is bringing wisdom, actually. Bringing wisdom to how one communicates in the world. And I think that, I'd like to suggest, you know, pay close attention to your communication if it feels appropriate. And notice when you feel really connected. Notice when, if you're distressed and a friend of yours or a partner or whoever can show up and give you support, or notice when you're feeling strong and you can give support to someone else. Notice when there are bumps in communication and see if you can do what we did, which is to really unpack the causes and conditions to understand them. It really cleared things up emotionally between us. There's no residue. Bringing wisdom to our experience, understanding what are the causes. The Buddha said, if you're suffering, then identify the cause and remove the cause. If you remove the cause, then the effect will fall away. So yesterday I came here to Albuquerque. A member of this Sangha hosted me, was so kind, essentially fed me a delicious homemade dinner and put me up for the night and made a lunch, sent me off with a lunch. It was so wonderfully generous. And I felt the enormous love and generosity in that act, and I felt wonderful gratitude. And I expressed my gratitude. I expressed it. Instead of just letting it pass, I expressed it. And I've essentially made a resolution in my own life that whenever I see goodness, I will speak it. And it's a wonderful thing to do. And then I went to this wonderful concert last night that another member of the Sangha made possible for me, another act of generosity. I felt enormous gratitude, and I acknowledged it. I spoke my gratitude and acknowledged the generosity, seeing the goodness of generosity. So I'd like to suggest, if this isn't too much to keep track of, is pay attention to when you're generous or when someone else is generous. And if you are generous, and this is not only with money, but it's with your time, with your attention, with whatever, in this case, food and a concert ticket, acknowledge the generosity in yourself. It's good. It's not egotistical, actually, to acknowledge our goodness. Celebrate your goodness. When you see it in someone else, celebrate it. Do you see, in that moment of celebrating either your own goodness or the goodness of someone else, you are connected and there's happiness. You know, so generosity brings us connection and happiness. Gratitude brings us connection and happiness, and these two things reinforce each other. Generosity and gratitude. How often do we not express it? You know, so I'm really determined, you know, to spread it around. Spread around the gratitude as well as the generosity. And this morning, you know, I decided to go for a hike up at Elena Gallegos fairly early in the morning, and I went to Sunflower Market to buy a couple of things that you can't buy in Embudo, New Mexico, where I live. And, you know, I was in the market, and I was looking for toasted sesame oil, and it wasn't in the oils. And I found somebody who was stocking shelves, and I said, "Do you have toasted sesame oil?" And she took me way over to some other part of Sunflower Market and showed it to me, and I said, "You know, if you hadn't been here, and if you hadn't helped me, I either wouldn't have found this, or it would have taken me a long time. Thank you." Really simple. And yet, that expression of gratitude and the honoring of her goodness, we connected. And I knew that because when I walked by her, you know, a few minutes later, you know, she said, "I hope you have a good day today." It's really simple. Acknowledging. And I happened to arrive at I stumbled into Sunflower Market when they were doing free breakfast for seniors. Right? I've never heard of such a thing. And since I'm a senior, and then since I only had a little bit of toast and coffee, I gratefully accepted it was not only breakfast, but it was really wholesome, delicious food. And there was this hearty woman, you know, flipping pancakes and scrambling eggs and welcoming everyone in, and there were a whole bunch of us seniors in there eating. And I felt such gratitude for that generosity. It's amazing. And, you know, it's a very good business technique, because I basically Sunflower Market has bonded with my heart, and I will, and my stomach, and I will go out of my way to shop at Sunflower Market because of this wonderful generosity. Last Thursday of every month, for those of you who have white hair, free breakfast at Sunflower Market. Maybe you know about this. I didn't know about it. So, acknowledging. The gratitude is happiness. The generosity is happiness. The love is happiness. You know, I never say goodbye to friends, whether I'm with them in person. Sometimes I forget, but mostly I remember. Or when I'm signing off, when we're saying goodbye on the phone, I don't forget to say, "I love you." You know, because at some point it's going to be the last contact. And I don't want it to be the last contact without acknowledging my love for someone. So then I went from Sunflower Market and I was going to go for a walk in Elena Gallegos, and it turned into a big hike. And it was just so beautiful. It was so beautiful this morning, the cool air, and it was clear, and the looking out at, I've lost the name, the big mountain over there that's the Navajo, Mount Taylor under the waning moon, and the trees were extraordinary, and the bird song, and I was experiencing a whole lot of rapture, and I just started going. And pardon me?
And your stomach was full.
And my stomach was full, yes. And I, you know, I got to about 7,000 feet, and I realized, okay, I was dressed like this. I had no water. I had no food. I was going for a walk. And I thought, I could make the ridge. And then I realized, you know, but it was walking meditation, and I was very aware. I was really coming back. The mind was not wandering. I was present for the experience of walking. It was meditation. The mind got very concentrated. There was a lot of rapture, you know. And then when I got up to about roughly 7,000 feet up into the Ponderosas, and I stopped and I realized I shouldn't go any further. It would be dangerous, actually. I stood there, you know, pretty high up. And I just felt the peace of the place. And then this profound peace came to this heart. And very, very deep contentment. And then very deep equanimity, because I've been suffering over this global warming business and the discovery that the Earth I have always known will never exist again, not in the history of humanity. And I've been suffering over it. And I stood there and I looked out on this planet, you know, and I know it's going to be Sonoran Desert. All those trees are going to be gone. It's going to be an austere, harsh desert here. But I looked at those trees and I saw that they're there now and that I love them. And then the mind dropped deeper because of the concentration. And wisdom came and equanimity came. And I realized this is only empty phenomena rolling on. These are only conditions. They're not happening to anyone. And then there was this really, really deep acceptance. So this is how it is. So be it. And the heart, which has been quite disturbed for days, went into a place of deep peace. You know, so it's possible in the midst of our lives to cultivate concentration, to cultivate this quality of acceptance and equanimity, to cultivate a quality of calm, of peacefulness, you know, of contentment. All of these things are possible. Right in the midst of our lives, even in very challenging circumstances. It's been very challenging for me in the last week, and I've worked it, and I've worked it, and I've worked it, and I'm moving through the challenge. So just an encouragement, just to review specifically what we can do in this intervening week until next week, is pay attention to everything that is good in your life. Pay attention when there's calm. You know, we tend to be so fixated on what's going wrong that we don't notice that there are moments of calm in the midst of all that. There are moments of calm in the midst of the anxiety. Notice when the mind is calm. Notice if there's any contentment at any time, and just really notice that instead of just being fixated on what's going wrong. Notice generosity in yourself and in others, and acknowledge it. Notice gratitude in yourself and in others, and celebrate it. Those are forms of happiness. Notice wisdom, which unpacks problems the way my partner and I unpacked what had happened between us. You know, understanding causes and conditions. Notice your relationship to pleasure. See if it's possible to experience what is pleasant, any kind of pleasure, without grasping, without clinging, just letting the pleasure, the pleasant happen, and responding with rapture, with delight, rather than with grasping. It's really possible to do that. And if there's grasping, notice that. Is that too much homework? Good. So essentially, you know, we're going to be talking about Downer next week, about opening to pain, which is really part of our path as well. But I'd like for us to come back and to share with each other the upper, you know, of all the forms of happiness that we encounter in the course of this week. So thank you. Thank you for your patience. Is there? We're running over a little bit. Is there, maybe 5 minutes? Does anyone have any comment or question? Yeah, please.
Could you tell us the name of the book that you're reading about?
Yeah, it's actually the most significant book I've ever read, and it's Bill McKibben, and it's called EAARTH. And essentially, what he's saying is that we have a different planet now, and we need to have a different name for it. Bill McKibben, EAARTH. And it's going to be hard to find because people don't want to read that stuff. But, yeah, and if you read it, get support. I'm serious.
How do you spell the letter?
Yeah, MC, capital KIBBEN. McKibben. McKibben. Okay, thanks so much, friends.
Thank you.